I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. Hi, everybody. It's Jason Klom, the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. This week, I am speaking with Christopher Corman. He's producer of a radio show that celebrates pop culture. He's also the son of one of my heroes, Harvey Corman. And he's here by phone to talk with us a little bit about his dad's career and what kind of stuff his dad passed on to him in terms of like his appreciation of comedy. So let's talk about that. So that doesn't always happen. You're not a comedian yourself, but I'm curious what kind of stuff passed down to you, though.
Well, Jason, thank you for it's a kind for you to say my dad was your hero. He was mine too. John Ritter and Dean Martin, my father, were my three favorite.
Wonderful.
Well, John Biner. So.
Okay.
The top four. Well, let me ask you, Jason. Not that you know you're interviewing me, but what is your age thing? I mean, how old are you?
I'm 38, but I am. Like, it was one of those things. Blazing Saddles was a movie my parents wouldn't let me watch until I was a teenager because of the language. And when I finally saw it, it blew my mind. And I'd already loved your father's work anyway, but that was the ultimate thing for me. And it is still my favorite movie of all time.
Well, I can delve into whatever it is you want to know about my father, his artistic experiences, his process, as much as you want.
Yeah. Honestly, even Wikipedia is kind of sparse. I'd like to know what you know about where he got started and who his influences were.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you, out of the four people on the Burnett Show, my father started with studying with Uta Hagen, who, if you want to talk about it, her top pupils were Matthew Broderick and David Hyde Pierce are her two-star pupils. So my dad started with Uta Hagen, but he went to Goodman Theater for 4 years with Shelley Berman and Geraldine Page.
Wow.
So my father is classically trained in all the classics. He did not go into thinking, Jason, that he was going to be in the vernacular of the business, sketch comedian.
Right.
He wanted to be that Renaissance performer who could do it all.
Sure.
Sing, dance, act, comedy, do drama, do voices, do everything. Because if you limit yourself in this business, you get typecast in this business.
Of course, of course.
And he wanted to avoid that. So he came out of Goodman in, 55. My dad and my mom went out in 60, and he started getting Red Skelton, Jack Benny. He got a few Lucy's. He got a Perry Mason, a Hazel. Three Munsters, and you just start making the rounds, and you get aware of these different casting people, and they start going, "Oh, this Corman guy is really good." And before you know it, really, there was only three channels back then. So there was only ABC, NBC, CBS. So if you made the rounds with all the casting people, you got a reputation, really good as being really good at one thing, but he could do it all. So, his big break was obviously Danny Kaye in 1963. That's where he really kind of became known as a sketch comedian, like one of the best. If you want to call Carl Reiner or Carney his fellow. I guess R. Carney and Carl are probably considered two of the other best second bananas in the business.
Sure, of course.
In the vernacular of the business. I mean, necessarily, you could ask Jesus if my dad were alive if he necessarily liked that word, second banana, but, it paid the bills.
Of course it did, yeah. So,
and I think Carol Burnett put him over the top, and I certainly think all his work with Blazing Mel Brooks absolutely put him beyond into iconic status.
Of course.
But he did four Brooks films, Blazing being my favorite. High Anxiety, History of the World Part 1, and Dracula Dead and Loving It.
Yeah.
So, and then for those who like animation, he was the voice of the Great Gazoo.
Of course.
Which a lot of people don't know. You would, because you are comedy aficionado like I am. You would know that. Now, you remember, in 65 or 66, someone will correct me on this, he only did 13 episodes of The Flintstones and became a cult character, even behind his wild imaginations.
Oh, I can imagine.
He never thought this little green guy was going to go that far.
Right.
And so he really has had this three-prong thing, or Burnett, Brooks, Gazoo. So it's really quite miraculous that, you know, he runs the gamut of so many different generations who know him from different worlds.
Right, right.
So, and many people can't say that.
No, absolutely. I'm getting the feeling that, you know, you seem to appreciate, and because you were probably there for a lot of it, of him being a working actor before anything hit. I mean, is that safe to say?
Yes. Yeah, it's very safe to say. My dad and my mom came out in 60, and you made your rounds, and I just don't, when he came out to California, Jason, he wanted to be the next Olivier.
Sure.
He done a Shakespeare Othello in Sam Mock in 1959, and Betty Davis and Charles Laughton came backstage and anointed him the next Olivier.
Oh, my God.
And he thought, all right, I'll go out there and be the next Olivier.
Sure.
And he said, all I could give them was an aging, balding Jew. and that's a quote from him, not from me. But he got into this realm of being, doing a great character actress. Did Donna Reed, did a lot of Donna Reed's Hazel and Munsters and all that. And 63, he got Danny Cage, and then Burnett in 67. And that seemed to really just kind of put him on the right map. He did some touring in plays. He did Norman, Is That You? So he did some summer stock stuff during the summer when he didn't do Burnett. And that's what actors did back then. They did summer stock.
Sure.
And you keep the skills refined. And in the early years, you did summer stock. You did Kennedy Players in Ohio. You did Milwaukee, did Chicago. And you did what you could to get yourself out there, pay the bills.
Sure.
And he learned doing comedy. When you're doing two or three shows a week, you learn where the jokes are. You got to work fast. So he came really very adept at knowing where the jokes are and being able to get the most out of every joke. But here's the thing. My dad didn't approach acting as a comedian. He approached it as an actor doing comedy, and there's a huge difference.
For sure.
If you're doing satire, you're doing farce, you're doing a parody, he says, you play the reality. You don't play the abstract. You don't play the craziness of it. You have to play the reality of it.
Right.
Because then it's believable.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're indicating by mugging, and if people don't understand what mugging means, people who make faces at the camera to indicate, okay, the punchline is coming. That is amateur.
For sure.
The Apollo.
Yeah.
He was probably one of the very few people, with a few exceptions, in the 70s, that was probably outside, probably Alan Alda, had that kind of multi-discipline talents that could do it all.
Right, right. I have wondered about, in terms of, any musical or dancing skill, because I don't have a ton of memories of Carol Burnett outside of some reruns that were on when I was a kid. I have limited exposure to the stuff that I love the most. So was he a singer, a dancer?
He, not by natural.
Mm-hmm.
He took dance, he took voice.
Uh-huh.
He took diction in college and high school. Some, but when he got into Goodman Theater, they taught you all that. They taught
sure.
you dialects, voice. That was part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
If you can move, if you could rub your stomach and whistle at the same time. You're really talented.
Right. I've always one thing I've really wondered about him for a long time is where he pulled his voices from, and also if he had kind of a thing in terms of some people have weird ways that they'll create a character. Like, oh well, if I you know, I find a hat, that's this character's hat, and this is what I base the whole character on. Did he have a one particular thing that he would latch onto, if you know, that would help him make the character his?
If he had to do a dialect. If he had to play a Russian person, he would get a phonetics book.
Okay.
And break down the phonetics of the dialogue of German or whatever he had to play. If you were going to work with Danny Kaye, who is considered one of the best dialecticians outside of Carl Reiner.
Of course, sure.
You better know your dialects. So he would get a phonetics book and break down the dialogue. So wow. If you're going to do Brooklyn, you're going to do Scottish, Cockney, you're going to do that. He had to learn it that way.
Yeah.
Wow. The character comes from, obviously, the theater. It's more of a inclusive process. You work with the writer, the director. You work with the character for a month or whatever, whereas TV movie, you better know your character right there because you're on a budget.
Sure.
But theater is more of an actor's medium. You have a better chance of playing with the text.
Right.
Than you do a TV and a movie.
For sure. Yeah. A lot more flexibility.
So he didn't, you know, he had a chance to do a national tour of La Cage aux Folles. And he passed on because he didn't want to play one character for like 8 months.
Really? Okay.
He told the producers, you want someone with a better voice. And who didn't want to do drag anymore,
uh-huh.
Or shows involving drag, as he had enough drag issues on Burnett's show to last
sure.
a lifetime.
I bet.
But he told the producers, "Do hire Peter Marshall."
Interesting. Okay.
So Peter Marshall played the role that Gene Barry played on Broadway, or. In the movie, he would have played the Robert Williams character.
Uh-huh, right,
right. Birdcage, same role.
Right.
Because my dad, like Carol, they grew up doing sketch comedy. They liked playing 8 or 9, 10 characters in one show. They didn't want to play one character. It gets stale when you have to play one character.
Sure.
Because you had to keep it interesting. So that's why Carol, my dad, I thought we were really so good at variety and sketch comedy because they got to stretch as artists.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, sketch is my absolute favorite. I mean, it's my favorite thing of all time. And, that is always one of the bonuses is trying to find a different way to play with the text or play with just your own body. Cause if you're, you know, you find like, oh, maybe I did this too much in the last sketch. I can mix it up a whole bunch and I can try different things.
Right.
I kind of want to talk about, cause I think at one point you and I had mentioned that, or you had mentioned to me rather that he was actually quite frustrated with the concept of, oh, you guys break all the time, which wasn't true, but he was quite frustrated with that.
And I'll get into this, and this is more a slam on Tim or anybody.
Sure.
He, because of his classical training, Jason, he had this little thing about staying on script, not breaking the fourth wall, not indicating to the audience, don't mug.
Yeah.
He was trained at Goodman Theater to play the reality of the character, to honor the writing. His writer wrote all this. He took the time to write it, at least honor him by doing it as written.
Right.
Now, I realize this is live television, it's sketch, but they did do cuts in between the sketch, the dress and air show on the Burnett show. But my dad's thing was, if the writing was really good, you shouldn't have to break character. And that's just not Tim. I don't mean Tim specifically. I mean, in general.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have to break character if the writing is there.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, he really hated breaking. Now, people come to expect it. There was, and my wife will be the first one to tell you, there is an immediacy to it. There is a now factor. There is a, wow, it's live.
Sure.
And they're breaking character. And there's a, the performer becomes accessible to you. It's not like, hey, like for these great thespian actors doing comedy, we're doing this schmaltzy whipped cream pie in the face bullshit. We're not doing Playhouse 90.
Right.
But my dad, how disciplined he was going to let him write his ticket. He was going to let him be the best he could be, which was, what is the next job? If people thought I break character, they're going to think I'm this undisciplined performer.
For sure.
So it became an image issue. It became of, if people think I'm undisciplined, how is that going to affect my next work?
Yeah.
My image as a performer. And I personally, between me and you and Jason, and you can ask anybody, some people loved the breaking up, some didn't like it. I think the frequency to which it happened, I thought it was a little too much.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I think he did too. But, you know, at the end of the day, it cemented my father and Tim as a great comedy team. It endeared them to their audience. It made them feel like they were in on the joke.
For sure.
So you can make the arguments for both. I personally didn't care for it.
Yeah.
But that's just me. I'm too close to it. So I have a bias that's nor good nor bad. That's just my reality.
Yeah.
I hate when Saturday Night Live does it because it's so inside on Saturday Night Live. Only the cameraman gets it.
For sure. Right, right.
Or the makeup guy or the usher.
Yeah.
So now your comedy taste, I don't know where it runs. Mine, like I said, I ran... John Ritter was my idol. Comedy idol. Robin Williams was my comedy idol. Dean Martin, John Viner, Rich Little. Those were people that I absolutely adore. There's a discipline to their talent that were like off the charts for me.
Yeah.
And John Ritter specifically, just because having known him, got to know him. And my dad and John were dear friends. I got to see their process up close. So... So that for me is just, because, you know, most people don't know this, Jason. Three's Company was next door to Burnett Show for a couple of years.
Oh, okay.
Because, and most people don't realize this, even though it was an ABC show, because CBS had the best technical crew, mm-hmm. the best equipment, the best everything at CBS, everybody wanted to work at CBS.
Right.
So Richard Klein and John Ritter during lunch breaks... We go to the bathroom from 31 over to 33 and sit there and watch rehearsals because the director, Dave Powers, who directed the Burnett Show, became the director of Three's Company. So Dave would always know where John and Richard were at lunch hour.
That's amazing.
And Dave would have to go over and corral John and Richard and go, you know, guys, we have our own show. And because Richard Klein told me a couple of times on Facebook, said, we would just go over there and soak up everything your dad was doing. We listened to him. We watched him, his crafts, his process, and watching Tim. And we just soaked it up, and we'd ask him questions. And whether you knew it or not, Chris, your father was a mentor to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Even though he didn't consider himself one, he was, just by the nature of him willing to share his process with people.
Right.
And he did it with such effortlessness and such genuine desire to want to help other performers. And that meant a lot to me for Richard to tell me that, because there are a lot of performers, Jason, who want to keep it to themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't want to share the brand with everybody. It. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, this is a secret. I can't show anybody. I don't want anyone to hide behind the curtain.
Right. Well, for me, the magic of his work, at least for someone like myself, was always that a lot of comics tell the story of like, you know, they didn't necessarily pay attention to comedy until one particular person. They're like, oh my God, I think I could do that. And whether you can or not, somebody who gives you the feeling that they're so at ease on camera or wherever you see them, that is one of those, it becomes a very special moment. And that, I mean, I know that I still watch him, and it's the same thing for me. I wouldn't want so badly to imitate him every time I watch him.
Right.
If it weren't the case, I mean, it was my dream to play Hedley Lamarr, and, you know, got to do it once. That was super fun.
Where did you do that?
I'm in a show every month, called A Drinking Game, where the audience drinks and we drink, and we do a stage reading. It's normally 80s or 90s movies, but one month a couple years ago, they said we're doing Blazing Saddles. And while originally I'm like, you know what, I want to play Gene Wilder's part. I sat and thought about it for 5 minutes. And I'm like, what am I thinking? I do not. I want to play Hedley Lamarr. There is no doubt in my mind. Because at first, like, there's this, oh, I need to be the star of the show. And you're like, no, idiot, you could be the Harvey Korman of the show. And I'm like, nope, done. I'm going to be Harvey Korman. And the bonus to the show is you get to, if you want, do an impression. As long as you can act within the impression, you get to do the impression, and that's what I chose to do. Hey everybody, it's Jason. This week, Comedy on Vinyl is proudly sponsored by $300 Data Recovery, and there's a very good reason for that. That's because there would be no episode this week without them, and we'd have had to start the entire show from scratch if we hadn't found out about their services. So, as you probably saw online a few weeks ago, my hard drive crashed. That was 6 terabytes, almost 1 million files, and they recovered everything for me. This was not an easy order either. I had 4 drives in 1 enclosure in a RAID setup, meaning you can't just plug in the drives and copy stuff over. They took my drives, examined them, determined whether or not they needed to open my drives up in their clean room. Luckily, they didn't for me, which sped some things up. And then they copied everything over to a very large USB drive for me. The rates are reasonable, as little as $300 a drive, hence the name. And they don't just work locally. You can send your drives into them. So go to $300datarecovery.com. That's the number 300, then $datarecovery.com. Check them out. And once you do, back that stuff up again. That's a big thing. I had a hard drive that was supposed to be foolproof, and it wasn't. And $300 Data Recovery helped me out, saving 26 plus years of writing, art, photos, videos, everything, including this podcast. So check out $300 Data Recovery and let them know that Jason from Comedy on Vinyl sent you. Now, back to the show. There's no way I wasn't going to do Hedley Lamarr. There was no way that wasn't. I wasn't just going to say, you know, oh, shit. I wasn't going to be like shit kickers and Methodists. No, idiot. You have to do it that way. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
Well, I could not in my wildest dreams ever attempt, in my wildest dreams, attempt any role my father ever did and think I could be as good as him.
Oh, no. Nope. Never. It was, like I say, an imitation and a pale one at that. But it got laughs. So I'll give it that. But of course,
I'll give you kudos for trying, Jason. I'll tell you that. I wouldn't even attempt at it. I don't have the balls to do it. I mean, I can quote his material. I can capture the essence of my father a little bit in moments, but I could not even attempt at understanding the subtextual approach to his comedy the way he did it.
For
and
sure,
think I was anywhere close to him. And we'll cover that when we get back on the podcast. I can cover the same stuff again if you want me to.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we can talk. We can talk about whatever you like. Let's see. That's what my question was going to be. So,
Are we recording still?
Yeah, I picked right back up. I picked right back up. We're good.
Oh, thank God. All right. I was scared there for a moment.
No, you're good. I did want to ask about you getting to watch him perform. Do you remember the first time you got to watch him perform? Any memorable stories about being on set or anything with him?
If you do the math, I was born the year of the Burnett Show.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't start going to tapings until probably 71 or 72.
Okay.
So if I really learned the art of what he did, I probably spent time with him when he did Norman Is That You on the Nashville tour. As I got older, I had a better understanding when he did Nut House, the sitcom with Mel Brooks and Alan Spencer from Sledgehammer. I was on the set all the time. I will give you some insight into what my dad felt about comedy.
Sure.
He hated it on camera because when you're doing one camera, you're not hearing the immediacy of the laughter, right? So you have to, there's a meter in your head that you have to think about 7 seconds, 8 seconds, and you have to assume the amount of time you're taking, the audience is giving it at home.
Yeah.
So with a comedian, a sketch comedian, in my father's case, is he wants to hear that immediate response if it's working or it's not.
Yeah.
So also with one camera, you're talking about shoot, relight, shoot, relight, shoot, relight. And to do physical comedy on one camera is hard because you have to imagine or assume the audience is going to get a physical gag or is going to get a faulty towers like joke. Because you have to assume the people at home are as smart as the people who are writing this.
For sure, yeah.
So that's why Jason, he hated doing one camera. He loved working with Mel. he loved working with Alan Spencer, but it just wasn't, it was longer days. And at his age, doing 12-hour days, 10-hour days, was not his cup of tea. He'd all be home watching the Dodger game, eating a tuna on rye,
mm-hmm.
hanging out with his son and his children playing tennis, and being and having productive time with family. He'd rather done that.
Yeah.
So the three-camera thing you have to think about is, it was, you know, they didn't get to the studio until Thursday, because most people don't realize this. Price is Right occupied stage 33 for most of the week.
Okay, all right.
So they, all right, so they don't get into the studio situation Thursday. So you're talking about a dry block. The cameramen have to get know where they need to be. They need to do pre-cordings of all the musical sketches during the week. So by the time Thursday comes up, it's rehearsal, dry block, dress rehearsal. And then they get to, then they tape two shows on Friday. So it's a fast week, and there's
sure.
rewrites through the whole week. I mean, the first script on Monday starts on maybe white, and by the time Friday comes along, it's red. So it's like 31 flavors of scripts.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many rewrites. They cut things during the week, things that don't work, that Carol doesn't think works, or Joe doesn't like, or my dad didn't like, or the writers thought this is a rehash of something we already did. So they'll cut, they'll add. And of course, you also know you have to deal with Conway, with the fact that Conway will do 17 minutes at a chair. And, you know, the joke on the Burnett show was, don't ever let Tim start the sketch entering.
Uh-huh.
Let him be already in it. Now, I will share this about my father. He had basically rules of comedy. Here's a perfect example. Wet with the Wind sketch. Down with the Wind sketch. You're doing Clark Gable. Obviously, you're doing a parody of something that's well-known.
Sure.
So if you're doing jokes like, I really like what you've done with the place, and the place is in shambles, you're playing the line straight, because that's funnier.
Sure.
Indicating this place looks like a piece of shit.
Mm-hmm.
My dad's rule was, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to swear, but.
You're fine, please. It happens all the time on the show.
Okay, so my father will say, here's my rules of comedy. A, it has to have a plot. It has to have conflict. It has to have a resolution. And it has to be based in believability. I don't care if you're doing farts, you're doing satire, you're doing parody, Chris. You play the truth. And then the absurdity will come out through that.
Yeah.
But if you indicate you're playing absurd, you don't get the joke and you don't get the laugh. And so, well, this is this way. I went to the Goodman School. I went to the Harvard School of Comedy with my father.
Sure.
So, and everything I know about timing and rhythm. And I actually told my dad this, and he thought I was absolutely off my frickin' rocker. I used to time him when he'd get a laugh, and I would time it with a stopwatch to see how long his laughs would last. And the average laugh for me would last 8 or 9 seconds.
Oh my God.
Because he can milk it, because he knew how to play the line. He knew the subtext of the line, what the line meant. He would give voice intonation. He'd give a facial expression. So that stuff you can't, I would say you can teach funny. I don't know if you can teach timing.
Right.
Either you have it or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those, like, it's like the funny, it's like that movie with Jerry Lewis, Funny Bones. Either you have it or you don't.
Right.
It's, my son has it. It's scary. He's 16 years old. And you think my father and Robin Williams inhabits his body.
Yeah.
Because my son, you can't teach what my son already knows about comedy. He has the ability to hold for a laugh and a look and a stare for my wife and I and get a laugh.
I love it.
And I don't know where he gets it from, Jason. I really don't, because he wasn't around my father a lot in those contexts like
sure.
I was.
Sure.
It's almost like the gene passed through me to my son. I got the receding hairline gene, and my son got the comedic genes. So some of you guys screwed on that. I guess it was me. But you know, the Mother Marcus stuff on the Burnett show, that was my grandmother. That whole Lainey Kazan crazy Jewish grandmother.
Uh-huh.
That was take every Jewish relative you've ever had. That's That's who his mother was. And so he played what he knew.
Yeah.
And that's a great, this is between me and you, Jason. I love, as much as I love my dad, Teddy Lamar in Blazing Saddles.
Mm-hmm.
He makes me laugh in High Anxiety even more.
Oh, of course. No, it's too much. It's so good.
It is.
You can't get around it. You cannot get around. I have been trying to figure out the magic of, you know, because I've seen Mel Brooks films more than I've seen anything else he's done. I've been trying to figure out what it is, because sometimes I dig really deep into comedy to try and figure out what makes it work, and then sometimes I will just let it sit there and I guess either wash over me or hopefully like get it by osmosis. And Blazing Saddles is one of those that I don't know. I can't touch either of them, but High Anxiety does have a particular something about it. Did you go to any of these premieres or anything with him? Were you on set for that one?
This is funny. My mom really, 77, 76, they were shot 26 blocks. They were doing the corridor set scene with Ron Curry and Mel, and they hear my dad screaming, doing the bonjour scene with chorus, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Of all the times my mom chose to take me over to see my dad, he's doing the bondage scene.
Oh God!
I don't know what Freud would say about that, but take your licks, man, take your licks on that. So I came around the corner of my dad's trailer, and I saw Cloris with that white face and that mustache. And at that moment, Jason, I needed a carton of Depends. Oh my God, that white face and the whole scene with the flute cup.
Of course.
In the dining room. And the whole scene with the paper clips and the werewolf scene with Ron Carey in the office. That is one of my dad's greatest moments in film. The whole werewolf thing with Ron Carey and Ron Clark and Mel in the office. When he's doing the paper clips and the rubber bands.
Yeah.
It is. I told my dad, it's like, Chris, we laugh so hard. Every time I put the teeth in, Mel and Ron would break up. I got so sore putting those freaking teeth in my mouth, and they had to put the things in my eye. And it just, but I'll tell you, Jason, comedy is exacting.
Yeah.
It is a finite amount of, if one thing is off, it throws the whole joke out of line. So Ron can't know my dad's doing what he's doing.
Sure.
Ron can't look over. He's got to stay on his line. My dad's got the time where Ron is in his speech. And so there's that thing where it's like comedy is a precise, it's a precision thing. And people don't realize unless you really do it a lot.
Yeah.
Just how it is about timing and trust with the other actor.
For sure.
High Anxiety was the second one my dad and Mel did. So my dad and Mel got to know each other and their rhythms, like Conway and my dad, Martin Willis, any of the great ones. But, you know, Mel told me at my dad's memorial, he said, as much as I love Carl Reiner, I said, I don't think there's anybody as good as your father.
Yeah.
And, you know, coming from Mel Brooks, I mean, come on, really? It's like
right.
God saying, your father's the best.
Right. Of course.
So for Mel to say that to me was like, wow. I think that's when I realized, you know, the amount of accolades I've been given, like Robin Williams' agent telling me, Robin was so scared to work with your father. My dad directed Carol Burnett, Carl Reiner, Robin Williams special in 87.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in the audience, and I'm watching, and I'm sitting back of Robin's agent, and he heard me talking, and my dad, the whole week was plot scenes. He's like, there's no way I'm going to direct Robin. There's no way I can tell Robin Williams what to do or where to stand. He's a comedy god. And his agent turned around and said, Chris, the other way around. Robin was so scared about working with your father. I said, Robin was scared about working with my father? Because looking generationally, like I'm 51.
Uh-huh.
I was 20 at the time. Who were the big people back then? It was Crystal. It was Ron Williams. It was John Ritter.
Yeah.
Okay. Those are the three comedy guys. I grew up with John Ritter and Ron Williams. Those are my comedy idols. Now, I love my dad. I'll be fair. But my generation was, those were the guys.
Sure.
So to have Ron Williams' agent say, he was afraid to work with my father was like mind blowing. That's when I got, oh my God, my dad's that big. I think that's when it hit, Jason.
That's
amazing. It is. And because a farmer doesn't ever want to make the director feel like, oh, I got this. I don't need any direction from you. Robin wanted to appease my dad. He wanted to work with Carol. He wanted to work with Carl. He wanted to work with Robin. He wanted to appease everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But they said, look, we just got to let Robin go on some of these sketches.
Sure.
We'll do the first one the way I want to do it or the way Carol wants to do it, and then we'll just let Robin go on the second one, on the second show.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, I met Robin when he was backstage afterwards, and he's like, you have no idea how, what a thrill it was to work with your father this whole week. And I'm slack-jawed. I'm like, Robin, you have no idea what it is to meet you.
Right.
You know, I idolized you for years. I said, well, Chris, anybody in this business idolized your father and Carol and Conway.
Yeah.
We watched them. So it was like, there is a mutual admiration society in that world.
Yeah.
You take from people that you know, and you know, people say stealing is not good, but in comedy, it's the highest form of flattery.
For sure.
To steal from other people.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So. I do it every month.
Me too.
I'm curious, I want to know a little bit more about your interest in comedy, because, I mean, anybody can be a casual observer and a casual lover. You come from a comedy family, fine, but I'm curious, what does it give to you to understand comedy in the way you do? Does it just make you appreciate the stuff you see more? I'm just curious how you see yourself in the world of comedy, a comedy lover who just really knows the ins and outs of it.
I think, well, it's like someone like John Ritter making those moments on Three's Company, like natural. To make something, to work a moment so it becomes organic.
Yeah.
And understanding their process, to hear them work a moment. There's a scene in Eunice, the 2-hour special with, where Mama dies. It's a 90-minute special about Eunice.
Uh-huh.
And it explains all about how the family came about. And my dad's hitting on Carol. And he's trying to hit on Carol. And he says to her, I would have to come over to my place. I got a new photograph needle. Now, who in the hell can make a photograph needle sound sexy?
Right.
My dad got a laugh that lasted 8.5 seconds. I couldn't believe it. So I asked him, why do you know that's why that's funny? I said, Chris, look at it. It's 1955. The idea of making a photograph needle sexy at that time, the absurdity of that comment is what you play. So I'm going to give emotion to a photograph needle.
Yeah.
I'm going to crunch up my face and get emotional about a photograph needle as if it's dice in a car or, you know, get something a woman a Mickey.
Right.
It's the absurdity of it.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, so I would watch both tapings, and both tapings were almost identical, but he got the second laugh longer than the first time. I said, how did you know that? I said, you just have to think about it. How long is the laugh going to last? As you do in front of live, they can always edit. But my thing is watching him work that moment with Carol.
Yeah.
How to hold it. Why you hold it long enough. And I think I just learned by watching him is, A, there's trust within the writer. The writer knows that my dad can embellish something and make something funnier or stronger or any performer. And that's why Carol and my dad were so good together. There was a trust. There was a respect for each other's craft. They didn't upstage each other. They tried to make each other stronger. But that was watching them together. Watching Ken Berry and or Betty White work a moment and find out where the joke is, where not to push this line, it was mind blowing to watch up front, up close.
Yeah,
and I'm only 14 years old, so it's like I'm never ever going to learn this anywhere else. Privileged I am to listen to this. These professionals at the top of their game make it look so easy, Jason, as if they were born to do it.
Right.
That's the magic of comedy, is when you don't think they've worked at it, and you know they have, but they made it look so easy, you think they were born to it.
It's nice to hear somebody appreciate it, because sometimes you get relationships are always different. Everybody's relationship with their parents is different, but it is nice that he was able to, not just pass on, hey, not only give you what sounds like a pretty great family life, but also pass on to you something that, even if you can't use it, is still important to you, which kind of speaks to, at least to a self-obsessed, comedy-obsessed nerd. It's like, okay, maybe comedy's got a little bit of a place outside of comedy, which is kind of nice.
It is, and I think I like to think to know within the world of growing up in that world, there are life experiences that he bestowed upon me. He taught me baseball. My love for baseball came from him going to ball games and sitting in him teaching me the nuances of hit and run. So my relationship with my father progressed beyond where it was just about, why is that joke funny? Well, whatever. So my maturation process as father and son grew out of probably the comedy, but it extended to other parts of my life. And if your audience doesn't know already or wouldn't know this, I grew up with a learning disability, a speech impediment. And my father was the first person to say, I'm not going to treat you any different because you have a learning disability. I'm going to celebrate your strengths and not your weaknesses. I'm going to celebrate who you are, not what you're not.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
And for those people who are out there who have a child with a learning disability or a challenge, it's very easy to blame, to get self-indulgent and go, woe is me. What didn't I do as a parent? Is that how do I hone in on the strengths of my son? And my dad pushed theater on me, because two things happen with theater. You address social development. You have to learn how to work with other people and compromise. But also the speech diction issue with my speech impediment, what's the best way to learn how to memorize lines and dialogue? To do theater. Do tongue-twisting songs. So he used it as an exercise tool for me to grow socially, emotionally.
Yeah.
And not realize that's what he was doing was, if you like what you do, it's not work. If you're evolving as a person in a world that you like, you're comfortable, and you like making people laugh, and I did so many plays in college and high school, is that I stopped being inhibited or the fear of, oh, I'm not as good as him. Obviously, I'm not going to be as good as my father, but I learned the discipline of, I can get over this fear of my speaking. I can learn dialects. I can learn memorization. Memorizing 80 pages in 3 days. So my LD combined with my love for theater and speech pathology, all of them came together and they infused as one. And I would never have had that had my father not been who he was.
Yeah. Wow. And to be able to do all that without having to, seemingly, it doesn't seem like you had to just sit there and compare yourself to your father. It was just like, oh no, this is a thing he gave me, another opportunity.
Here's a funny story. You're going to appreciate this.
Uh-huh.
When my father got out of college, they tell you to take one of those vocational tests to find out what you want to do.
Yeah.
So he cheated on the test the first – he cheated the second time. Now, the first time he took it, it told him he wanted to be – it told him he should be a mortician. Here's the funny part. Okay. He cheated the second time, and it came out the same way.
Oh, my God.
So I said, Dad, it's almost irony that it said you should be a mortician. I said, why? Because you died many times on stage. And I said, and you also killed many people on stage with your humor. So he said, you've been talking to your mother. Stop doing that. You know, I'll tell you, I appreciate you letting me talk about the LD part, because I think humanizing my father is, he really was my idol in the sense that he did celebrate my challenges, not as a blight on our family name. Although I told my dad, let's be fair, I think the cross-dressing took care of my social development for a couple of years. And he said, oh, what do you mean? I said, I didn't have to worry. I mean, I went to school. Most people, parents are a lawyer, you're a doctor. What does your father do? He cross-dresses on television and he does voices for aliens. you're wondering why I'm not in therapy. Okay, the lump bump. So it became a running spiel joke with me. Like, I can play off this special ed speech impediment and say, well, look, my father's a cross-dresser on TV. I got no problems. I'm normal compared to that schmuck on television dressed up like a freaking chicken every Friday night. So I'm got made. So it's a nice play off of something that you can like you can take the uncomfortableness of whatever insecurity I might have felt as a child, but at my age at 51, doing what I do as a producer and whatever, it's. Let's be fair, Jason. I wouldn't be talking to you right now. I wouldn't be talking to the half the people that I would be talking to in my lifetime had my father not been my father. So I count my blessings because of who he is. I wouldn't get a chance to meet people like you.
Well, I mean, so, boy, I got to tell you, this has been a friggin' blast. And I at some point, I actually would like to talk to you a little bit more about him as well.
Please do.
And
that comes from my heart, Jason. That comes from my heart because... I can count my blessings on this fact. I can say that all my blessings that I've had from my father cannot be measured by a dollar sign, an Emmy nomination, a ratings point. It is the relationship that I got to build in my life, the people I got to know in my life, and I include you in that. And I want you to know that.
Well, I very much appreciate it. And if it wasn't for this ridiculous podcast, I wouldn't get to meet like people like yourself. I mean, it's a silly show, but through it, I have.
Yes, it does.
I've either met my heroes or I've met people who know my heroes who can give me like a peek into their lives. There's one other peek I want to make though, because he specifically. So you said your favorite performance. Pretty much is him in High Anxiety, correct?
Yeah, people think I'm nuts when I see that.
I don't think so. I think that's a perfect, that's a legitimate it's a great part. I mean, that's silly that anybody wouldn't whatever.
Well, I think because of the the irony or the iconic cycle of his career.
Mm-hmm.
You say Burnett, you say Blazing Saddles, and I understand the evolution of that thinking.
Sure.
But my love for a certain role for my father is obviously not going to be somebody else's. And why High Anxiety hits different for me than Blazing. Because Cloris and Malin and everybody who are in these movies, Mel is smart enough to surround himself with the best people to bring out the best in him. And Mel is smart enough to do that. But I just think there's moments in High Anxiety that just blow me away that Blazing didn't do for me. And I can't tell you why.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me personally, I can see that look in his eye. There's just a different moment from my father in certain scenes in High Anxiety that, and Blazing Saddles is still going to go down as probably one of his best roles.
For sure, of course, yeah.
In most people's eyes, including yours, including most people's, but I think you get why I put High Anxiety over Blazing Saddles. I think you're the first person that's actually touched on it. To tell you the truth, you're actually the first person that's let me talk about it.
Really?
Because you hit something, Jason. You hit something. I don't know. You instinctually understand because you love comedy like I do, but because your love for my father, maybe there's a kismet connection that we have about High Anxiety together that's there, and we're not aware of it because everybody talks about Blazing Saddles or History of the World Part 1.
Sure.
High Anxiety becomes like an afterthought. I don't know.
Yeah, and that's unfair. Do you know what his favorite role was, though, of all time? Do you have a...
Oh, God, he's had to say Kelly Lamar.
Really?
For him? I think his overall work, I think he's had to say body of work over a period of time. I'd say anything with Carol and anything with Mel and anything with Tim.
Yeah.
Are his top three people... And that's not to say he hasn't worked with other people that he loved, didn't love less or more. But I could tell the emotional connection he has with Mel Carroll, my father, goes beyond their work. So there's a connection that I have with these people because of that probably relationship. But, you know, I'll be the first one to call me up and say, what worked and what didn't work, you think, on this. I'm like, you're asking me? Let me remind you, Dad. You pay my bills. There's a good reason why I don't bite the, you know, bite the hand that feeds me. I said, so I will stand back and I'll make sure that there's not a steak knife in your hand if you ask me that question again. But he'll also say what worked and didn't work.
Yeah.
And you know how mind-blowing that is for someone like my father. But you know what, Chase, I'll tell you the truth. My father was also very insecure. He wanted to know what other people thought.
Sure.
Because people who are very secure with their talent and as good as they are, they don't necessarily want validation or don't want to hear from somebody who don't know what it takes to get to that level because they don't understand what it took to get to that level. He'd be the first one to call me up. And I'd be like 10 o'clock at night. I'm like, I got to work the next day. What is it you want? I'm like, what? It's like, you watched Snowhouse tonight. What was funny about that? What didn't work? What did I force?
Oh.
And Dad, when have you ever been bad?
That's amazing.
As long as you know you gave it your all, the moment worked for you. If the other people around you didn't reach your level of performance, that's not on you. That's on them. Because maybe they were intimidated. They were working with the great fucking Harvey Korman, and they were probably scared shitless. Because I would have needed the pens if I had to work with you.
Right, right.
And I got to be on Nut House with him. I got to do a scene on Nut House with the sitcom with Alan Spencer about Fawlty Towers. And it said, in case the fire, break glass. And I'm standing behind the glass window as a fireman, and he walks by, and he waves to me, and I wave back to him.
Really?
And that's the one moment in my life I got to interact with my father on camera.
Oh, that's so great. Well, I love that. That's so wonderful. Not only do you get to do that, but you're his personal litmus test. I mean, come on. That's pretty great. That's pretty great.
And I get to share it with you, so that's even better. Because I don't get to talk about these things with most people. Most people want to hear about everything else.
Right, right.
So I appreciate you letting me talk about this. I really never got to share that with anybody. My wife is like, okay, I've heard this story 17 times. We've been married 17 years. And, like, my wife is like, she's like, can we get on with dinner? Like, can we, you know. So my head's off to my wife. She's had to deal with a very unorthodox upbringing that I've had. Mm-hmm. And there are moments where there are times, and I hope the listeners and I hope you will understand what I said. I love my dad dearly. But there have been times where it has been more of a burden than a plus.
Sure.
Because it's that fine line between, am I Chris Korman, the person, the father, the husband, or Harvey's son? And walking that line between when I need to be which one has been blurred at times.
Sure.
And I've had to learn how to measure those roles. And sometimes I have resented it, and sometimes I have loved it. And I love it when I talk to you, but there's time during the day where at 5 o'clock, I stop being Harvey Korman's son, and I got to be a husband and a father.
Of course.
And so, Mike will give me that look like, it's 5 o'clock, turn it off, no more phone, it's time to be a husband and a father.
Of course.
It's not been fun. It's not been easy.
I bet.
And I don't want to sound like I'm griping that I'm ungrateful.
No.
But there are times being the son of someone famous, it's not fun.
I cannot imagine. But I do like that you've taken away from it a plenty of positive and appreciated.
Much more than negatives.
I want to make sure, is there any place people can find any of the stuff you work on, or is there anything you want people to seek out of your dad's work or your work?
If people really want to hear, like your show, if people want to hear stories about some of the great comedy talents, TV Confidential, we have a subscription channel on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
Called TV Confidential with Ed Robertson. We've had Peter Marshall, we've had Jacqueline Smith, we're going to have Carl Reinerson, we're going to have Mel Brooks soon.
Wonderful.
On our show. I personally, if they want to go on YouTube, there's a fish called Wanda, the thing with the fireman that I talked about. I'm on not YouTube on an episode called Fish Called, it's Nut House. It's called Nut House. A fish called, I can't remember the title of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an episode of Mama's Family where Mama and Naomi are having a battle over a rug that Mama burned. And I'm in the pew behind Ken Berry. And I'm 17 years old about. And I can say this. It looks like they took scraps from a drapes from an IHOP in 1972 and made a freaking shirt out of it.
Really?
It looks like a test pattern for the blind. It is the most hideous looking shirt. Now, mind you, I'm supposed to be in Raytown, Kansas, so I'm supposed to look like a moron. I didn't have to work at it. And they put enough makeup on me to make even a living look, you know, the dead look alive. I mean, it was just like gods of makeup. And my dad said he came up to do notes one time to do the sketch and do the scene in the courtroom. And he said, you know, Chris, he was telling the extras, react to this and react to this and react to that, react to this, react to that. Make a face because you don't know when you're going to be on camera. So try to look like you're amused and try to look alive. And try not to look stupid and out of it. I'm like, I'm looking at him. I say this straight face. I'm like, you're telling me not to look stupid. And really? Give me a break. That's the best note you got for me, not to look stupid and dumb. And now, mind you, he played Ed. Now, my dad, he played Ed on Mama's Family.
Right.
He hated playing that hick. He hated playing that dolt. I said, Dad, but you're so good at it.
I love it.
He said, will you please stop talking to your mother? So you know, I'm on a couple of Mama's Families. I'm on a couple of Mama's Families. I'm on a couple episodes of Nut House. You have to catch me really quickly. I'm the tall one with red hair. But I haven't done a lot of it. I did a couple of shows that he did. I can promote this on your show.
Yeah, go ahead.
I haven't told anybody. In February 23rd in Lake Havasu City. On February 23rd, I'm doing a two-man, like, almost after studio thing in Lake Havasu City, Arizona, with a guy named Roger Galloway, a radio personality in Arizona, and we're doing a retrospective on my dad's career.
Oh, wonderful.
So if you can make it out there, it's called the Refuge, it looks like Refuge, but it's the Refuge Country Club in Lake Havasu City. It's an hour and a half, and we're going to do clips on Blazing Saddles, his cover this somewhat of the full spectrum of my dad's career.
Uh-huh.
If we did my whole dad's career, we'd be there all freaking night.
Of course.
So it's an hour and 15 minutes of a question and answer period. We're so close and we're talking about my dad's career. And it's like the Lake Havasu City, Arizona. And it's done by Roger Galloway. And when I get closer, if you have a website, I'll let you know. I can post it. There's promotional stuff on it. I'll let you know. So if you want your listeners and you to know and want to come.
Definitely. Yeah. Please let us know.
So, so without sounding cheesy and this sounds awful, I'm so glad we have this time together.
Me too. Absolutely. This was a blast. So, thank you so much.
Well, Jason, thank you for reaching out to me. I really appreciate it. When I can do things like this, it's fun because I get to tap on subjects I never got to tap with anybody else. So this has been a blast for me too. So
thank you so much.
You're welcome, Jason. So now where are you? You're somewhere in California, right?
Yeah, I'm in Burbank.
Okay. I didn't recognize the area code. That's why.
Oh, okay.
I fly into Burbank anytime like I come into LA because I avoid LA. Like
smart
the,
man.
LAX like the plague.
Yep. Me too.
And it's just easier to get in and out of.
Yeah,
because I took the latest flight. If I had to go to LA for business on anything, I think the latest is 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
The first half hour for me is crop dusting. The last 15 minutes is like, well, here we'll throw your dessert or your drinks and the peanuts at you.
Yep.
Whatever you catch is yours.
Well, if you fly into Burbank at any time and you've got time, let me know. It would be super fun.
I will.
To meet up.
Well, we should go get coffee. We'll go to CVS or the Grove.
Yeah.
And we'll go shoot the shit, as they say.
That'd be super fun. Oh, I realize I didn't do a... Yeah, please do. I realize I didn't do a wrap-up. Let me do a real quick wrap-up. Chris, again, thank you for doing the show. And
my pleasure.
Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. This episode is also underwritten by $300 Data Recovery. Visit $300datarecovery.com to get a quote on their highly recommended data recovery services. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years.